Welcome to the Your Courageous Life podcast, where we discuss psychology and tools to help you create better habits, cultivate discipline, and live with courage, aka grit and emotional resilience. I'm your host, Kate Swoboda. Learn more about my books and get additional resources at yourcourageouslife.com. And now, here's today's episode. Oh, I've got a good one for you today, y'all. We're going to be talking about how to release old relationship dynamics. And I'm going to be getting somewhat personal because I've got some strategic tools that I've used in my relationship with my husband of almost 20 years that we have learned through working on our relationship with couples counseling that have profoundly changed the trajectory of our lives and gotten us through some really, really hard times where we just were not aligning. We were not seeing eye to eye. And in case you're wondering, yes, it totally is a mind trip to me to go, wait, hold on. We've been together almost 20 years. Wait, what? How'd that happen? I know. I don't look a day over 25, but yep, that's us. I think we're going on 19 years this next upcoming anniversary. So in talking about releasing old relationship dynamics, I really do believe that all of the tools I'll talk about today are going to be helpful for you in any relationship, family, intimate, or otherwise. But I'll probably use a lot of examples of intimate or romantic relationships today because my husband and I have been together for many years. So that's my most applicable experience. But I've worked with individual coaching clients on things they wanted to change, relationship dynamics they wanted to release, and how to do the work on their end that might contribute to a positive change in their relationships. And I have found that these are helpful tools in those situations as well. Now, I've been talking a lot about relationships the last couple of episodes. I keep putting out the disclaimer that you have to know what kind of relationship you're dealing with. Because 100%, some relationships are just outright abusive. And unfortunately, if there is a situation where there's certainly where there's physical abuse, I want people to get help. And in situations where there's emotional abuse, it is worth understanding that one of the things that can happen in an emotionally abusive relationship is that your attempts to try to make things work better end up getting twisted. And so everything that I'm going to be talking about for how to release old relationship dynamics in this episode, it's going to apply to a situation where you and the other person have some level of equal investment in trying to see positive improvement. So there's really that sense of positive regard for one another, even if you're frustrated with the person. There's also this desire to, between two people, go, okay, if something isn't working, I want to make it better. So just putting that out there as well. With my husband and I feel really lucky, and I'm going to paint a bit of a picture here of what it looks like on the other side of some of this work. We are the best of friends. We laugh together every day. At some point, there's something we laugh about. I feel really proud of the work that we've done together, which definitely has not always been easy to do, but we've been really courageously committed to doing it. It feels really good to be able to say that I love him more with each year. And it feels really good to, and this might sound kind of odd, but it feels good to see how we bring out the worst in each other when we're agitated. I know that would sound weird, but let me finish. But that we have tools for understanding and healing the parts of ourselves that are reactive or agitated. And as a result, the work on the worst of ourselves has brought out the very best of ourselves. It is a really cool thing to me to look back over time and see definitively that our relationship is stronger and better than it was the year before and the year before that and so on. And I share all of that to paint a picture of what it looks like to heal long-term patterns with someone. I know that there was a time where I didn't feel optimistic. I didn't know what to do. And not because he was the problem exclusively and I was looking at him like, I don't know what I'm going to do with you. Like, we were not working. And I think there was also a time where I saw the value of the work that we were doing, but I was also kind of going, okay, but so when do we get the result? Where are we going to end up here? What's happening? And so I want to be transparent about that, because I'm sure there's somebody listening to this who is in one of those two places, either in a relationship with someone where they're going, I don't know that this is going to work, or in a relationship with someone where they're going, I want it to work. I see how the work is valuable, but like, when do I get the relief? And I don't have an answer, of course, for when do I get the relief, but I can say that it is possible. Where I feel like I am today is just more deeply connected, more in love. When he enters a room, I still look at him and have that little thrill in my heart. So enough of me being a goober. Let's get into the tools to release old relationship dynamics. And I decided I would break this episode into two sections. In the first section of today's episode, I'll get you thinking about what puts the dynamics in place and how to talk about those dynamics openly. And the second section of today's episode, I'll talk about specific actionable tools. Very intentional to set it up that way, because we've probably all seen the like 5 tools to improve your relationship articles. And without the context of understanding the dynamics themselves, I don't always know how helpful those are, or it might feel like putting a Band-Aid on a bullet hole. So let's start with that understanding piece. So first, understand that what you and the other person in the relationship bring to the relationship is this amalgamated reflection of all of your past history of relating to other people. You learned how to relate to others based on your parents and how they related to you. You learned how to relate to others based on what you saw modeled between your parents. If you didn't grow up with your parents, caregivers, whoever raised you. You learned how to relate to others based on the media and the models that you saw there. And I will say that while this is something of a stereotype, it does have to be pointed out that men in particular tend to learn a lot about relationships based on media. And if what they see on media is the toxic masculine stereotype of the cool guy who's like not going to get into his feelings, da, 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 like that is going to have an impact on someone. So there are a lot of examples I could get into for how media can influence us, but I do think it is important to put that out there, that it's not just what you saw between the marriage or partnership of the people who raised you. It's also what you saw in other marriages and other partnerships. It's also how your parents specifically related to you as an individual. And there is a genetic component to how we relate. That might surprise you, but for instance, I'm sure you've heard of introverts and extroverts, with introverts preferring more time in solitude, extroverts preferring more time in the company of others. How much you want to be in the company of others is going to be tied to how you relate to others. And introversion and extroversion are thought to be about 50%, about half, due to your life experience shaping whether or not you're introverted or extroverted. And about 50% genetic. I actually found research on PubMed. You know me, I'm always talking about PubMed when I talk about research. It's my favorite little place to hang out and nerd out. But I found some research on PubMed that actually ties introversion to higher levels of dopamine. And I don't feel like the research I saw would enable me to say this means this necessarily. So I'm not drawing an exact conclusion from that research. I don't think anyone is. But there are some who hypothesize that if someone's born genetically and produces genetically higher dopamine levels, that that could predict a higher tendency towards introversion. Other studies place more emphasis on the impact of your environment or your conditioning in shaping whether you're introverted or extroverted. But it's generally agreed that there's at least somewhat of a genetic connection. So yeah, some aspects of how you relate to others are going to be tied to your genetics. Now this leads me to discussion of attachment styles, which has become a really popular framework based on attachment theory to explain relationship dynamics. So a couple things that you might want to know about attachment styles. One, it's a theory. It's not empirically validated. So this means that we might find some usefulness in the concept of attachment styles to describe our experience in relationships. But sometimes I do see people on social personally taking it to the level of, and I don't particularly agree with this, but also taking it to the level of advising others of, if I'm avoidant in relationships, it's because my parents must have been horrible parents who conditioned me to be avoidant in relationships. I think that that's a stretch. I think that that needs more nuance. People react in all kinds of ways to their upbringing. I think we can look at addiction and substance use as a great example of that. Some people, and yes, the research does indicate that if you grow up in a home where your parents or caregivers are addicts, are using, they're alcoholics, especially if any of that behavior is happening in front of you, the children growing up in that environment are more predisposed to becoming alcoholics. But just because you grew up in an alcoholic home or a home with addiction does not mean that that's what will happen. It's not, I have this label, therefore I'm the child of an alcoholic, therefore this will be my destiny. It's not that cut and dry, because there are plenty of people who have grown up in alcoholic or homes with addiction. They won't touch the stuff. This isn't an exact example, but both of my parents smoked cigarettes growing up in the house with me all the time around. I hate cigarettes. I will not touch cigarettes. I hate being around people who are smoking. I hate it. So just because you grew up a certain way, just because your parents raised you with a certain attachment style, if it's a helpful way for you to frame your experience or articulate your experience or understand your experience, great. But we need to be aware of where we start to limit ourselves or how we see other people with labels like that. Mostly my concern is that when people over-identify with a label, they tend not to look deeper or question the label or look at the nuances, and then the label itself becomes limiting. We might, you know, somebody who's doing that might look at potential partners and go, oh, well, they've got an avoidant attachment style. When first of all, you're not qualified to quote unquote diagnose that. Second of all, I don't think there's diagnostic criteria for that. Third of all, it might be that that person is not usually displaying avoidant attachment, but is just avoidant in the context of being overloaded at work, you know, or some other explanation for their behavior. I also think, too, that over-identifying with labels can make people feel as if they will never succeed in relationships if they have determined that they have, you know, if they say, I've got an anxious attachment style. So we just need to really make sure that we don't get into that over-identification. Same thing could happen with introversion, extroversion. I've absolutely heard someone say, I'm an introvert, and that's why I struggle with connection. And I've seen people trying to be social media influencers who do a whole thing on, like, here's the five reasons why introverts struggle with connection. And it's like, nah, actually, maybe your introversion has nothing to do with why you struggle with connection. That's actually a stereotype about introverts. I'm highly introverted. I need a lot of time alone in order to function well. But I also do love connecting with people. Like, I love a dinner table with people talking about their lives. That's great. I just then want the alone time afterwards. So generally speaking, labels, helpful for us to try to articulate and make sense of what we experience, but they become less helpful when we start thinking that we can or can't do something, that other people can or can't do something, because we've already predetermined via the label that something is or isn't within the boundaries of what that label encompasses. And that's important because we've all heard people, they'll say, yeah, the reason the relationship broke up was because they're this. They're a narcissist, or they're avoidantly attached, or maybe, but there's a lot that goes into diagnostic criteria, and there's a lot that goes into why relationships do and don't work. So, labels and frameworks, yes, use them in the sense of they are helpful to speak about, to articulate things, to process your experience, even if it isn't validated by data. And I'm actually going to get into a lens that I use that is not empirically validated. And it is the lens of, I'm looking over at my dog right now. She's dreaming. Lola Bear. My dog is dreaming. And so she's starting to bark in her dream. I don't know if anyone picked up on that. I will leave this in the recording, in fact. She's like over there snoozing, my little Lola. I call her Lola Bear, as you heard. And when she dreams, sometimes she like starts squeaking because she's a teensy little 7-pound chihuahua. And she starts, I don't know, I guess barking in her dreams and squeaking. So, all right. So back to relationship dynamics. You're getting a real behind the scenes here. Speaking of concepts or frameworks that can be useful, but that are not empirically validated, I want to share the lens that I use, that my husband and I use for our relationship. And it is the three-part, an inner kid, an adult, and a higher self. So that each of us, that I myself, that my husband, that each of us have these kind of divisions within ourselves that we respond to life from. The inner kid self, the adult self, and the higher self. So let me lay this out there. So in this framework, the inner kid is us experiencing the world through our emotions. And inner kids just want fun. They want to be nurtured. They want to be cared for. Standard inner kid desires. They also can be very emotional. Inner kids don't have a lot of tools for how to navigate their emotional experience of the world. The adult self is experiencing the world through logic. That's the part of us that can think through solutions and strategy, right? That's, you know, very adult. Like, okay, I look at my situation and I go, here's what we need to do. And the higher self is almost beyond words. The best you can say is really, it's experiencing the world through pure presence or spirit. So one way that I've sometimes explained how these different aspects of the self can show up is like this. Maybe you've gone to visit your family. And before the visit to your family, you felt really centered and aware of how you'd handle any conflict if it arose. Or maybe you're not even thinking about conflict. You're like, this is going to be great. But then when you're in your family's presence, you felt really agitated and upset and just like, oh, like, why does my mom always have to boss me around? Or why does my dad always have to, you know, whatever it might be. And it, like, I'm not saying this is resulting in fisticuffs, right? But just that annoyance with family members. Here's what in this framework is going on there. The adult was operating before the trip, logically feeling like, yeah, this is going to be great. And if there's any problem that arises, yeah, we'll find a solution. We'll work it out. But your quote unquote inner kid self was re-stimulated in the presence of your family members and all of the relational dynamics that are just sitting there at home waiting for you when you come back. And it's bringing back all of those old inner kid feelings and bringing up those old inner kid emotions until, of course, those emotions are resolved, which is, to me, the heart of that inner kid work. I remember that the first time this framework was presented to me, it just clicked. It made so much sense. It was like, oh, okay, that's why I feel like things with my family are going to be fine 1 minute, and then I'm annoyed the next minute. And then like somehow we're in the same kind of annoyed dynamic that we've been in for a long time. Like, why? When are we going to grow past that? The higher self in this scenario would be the part of you that understands that, like, look, we're all on some kind of journey in this life. And part of my journey is intertwined with the very same family members who can feel so challenging. And their journey is intertwined with mine. I'm not saying that I'm perfect. I'm not. I'm sure I've done annoying things. Guarantee you have done annoying things. So it's that inner kid, adult, higher self. And I find that lens to be so helpful for this reason. It helps me to have more compassion for myself and for others who might be at capacity or dealing with all they can deal with. If I understand that it's not me at my core, it's an aspect of myself, a re-stimulated inner kid who's so reactive, it's just easier to go, okay, hold on. What does that inner kid need right now? And if I see it in someone else, it's a little easier to not take things personally. So people learn best through examples. So I'll give a couple of examples. If I see and understand that the reason my friend isolates and gets avoidant when she's going through a hard time, if I understand that that's because that's what she had to do to survive as a kid, survive physically maybe, survive emotionally, psychologically, her survival was to isolate and avoid. Then it's easier to have compassion for someone rather than taking it personally and thinking, why did they do that? Don't they see that they shouldn't do that? Or why do they have to? When we make those comments that someone else should be doing X, Y, Z as a response to life, we're doing that based on our own personal experiences. Maybe in your childhood, it was safe to talk about what you were feeling. But in your friend's childhood or your partner's childhood, isolation was the only thing that was safe. Maybe that's true for your family members. Maybe you hate the way your dad isolates when he's uncomfortable with a situation. You wish he'd just deal with it instead of hiding out. But maybe for your dad, with how your dad grew up, isolating and hiding out was the only safe thing he could do. And with safety, again, I'm talking about physical safety and emotional or psychological safety, but I actually don't want to go into, like, I'm not trying to go into safety as in like extreme abuse. There's also emotional safety in just being able to be who we are. So your dad who isolates instead of dealing with conflict, maybe his parents were great. Maybe they didn't beat him. Maybe they didn't tell him he was dumb. Maybe they didn't do anything that would typically classify as emotional or physical or psychological abuse. But in terms of him being safe to just be how he was, maybe they teased him. Maybe they actually told him when there was conflict between your dad's parents, I want you to go to your room. And then they had the argument downstairs. And that sort of conditioned your dad to think that the way to deal with conflict is get the hell out of the room. You know, so you can have really, really great parents who did the best that they could. You know, no parents are perfect, but like really, really loved you and tried to meet your emotional needs. And you can still learn patterns based on what you observed that you turn to as an adult, someone in an adult body, but that re-stimulated inner kid will turn to try to cope with life, with stress, with conflict. So again, I'm not saying that this inner kid, adult, higher self framework is validated by research. It ain't. I see it as just another way, and I've found it in my own relationship, my own marriage, as a helpful way of articulating and moving through what we experience in our relationships with others. So this podcast is about how to release old relationship dynamics, and I'm explaining that this lens where the old dynamic that someone is bringing to the relationship is this inner kid self that's re-stimulated, old patterns that get re-stimulated. In my own marriage, my husband and I use this lens as a way to talk about behavior. We openly refer to those inner kids that sometimes drive our behavior. And by the way, it's a new year, it's, you know, new millennium. Let's just not be too cool to deal with this concept of the inner kid, right? Like I definitely was in that for a while, but it, I get it. It's kind of cheesy, but if you are able to drop into that as a concept, it really does help because we expect different things, different levels of maturity from kids than we do from adults. And it's just so much easier to have some compassion when we realize I'm not dealing with someone coming from their adult self right now. I'm dealing with someone who's coming from their inner kid self. So let me get into an example. Sometimes in my relationship, I'll get hooked into a perfectionistic pattern. Sometimes. A lot of times. Plenty of times. I've already done work around that. I recognize it as a pattern that operates in my life as a response to my childhood where I tried to do everything quote unquote perfectly so that the adults in my life wouldn't get mad at me. AKA, it was a pattern I learned in order to survive. And this is in being raised, when I say survive, again, I wasn't beaten. Okay. Like, I'm not talking about a situation where I was like, I was hiding in a corner somewhere. That wasn't the situation. People learn patterns to function, to survive, to protect their innermost selves. And that can happen in any kind of parent, child, you know, or however you're raised kind of situation. If I am hooked into that perfectionist pattern and notice that in an interaction with my husband, I might come back to him later and say, hey, I'm sorry about how rigid I was earlier with just like really wanting things to go a certain way. I think I had some inner kid stuff coming up around perfectionism. That explanation, at least in our marriage, is not a way of quote unquote getting off the hook for poor behavior. It's just a way of trying to explain our experiences to each other. And he's got his own inner kid patterns, and he'll bring that to me sometimes. And when he does, because we have this way of labeling that inner kid self, that's an example of how it becomes helpful, because it's easier for me to see that he's just my husband. He's just like me. He's a fumbling human. He's doing his best. Old patterns play out. It makes it easier for me to have compassion, to not take things personally, to not go down the downward spiral of thinking like, oh my God, look what he did again. And how's this relationship going to work? And what are we even doing? And why are we even doing it? And all that. So I think it's just easier to really be with other people when we have some kind of framework for depersonalizing the behavior. The interesting thing about this work is that it's also been part of releasing old relationship dynamics. We can look back over the expanse of time and see that there are the people we were when we entered the relationship who were less aware of those inner kid selves and the influence an inner kid can have. And then in naming the inner kid behavior, it's easier to acknowledge that that was what it was. It's inner kid behavior. And now there's something different between us that's emerging. In knowing that my inner kid behaves X way, Y way, Z way, it's innocent. It's not intended as harm. And we can identify the alternative. If my inner kid is struggling with a pattern of perfectionism, then how I grow, how I leave the old relationship dynamic behind, is working on myself to heal the perfectionism. If my husband's inner kid is struggling with people pleasing and that impacts some of his behavior, then how he grows, how he leaves the old relationship dynamic behind, is in healing the people pleasing. Another way to look at relationship dynamics, if you take on this concept, is that they play out like familiar dance moves. First, the other person does this, then I do that, then they do this, then I do that. And all it takes to interrupt a dynamic like that is for one person to shift how they approach the dance. It only takes one person to use different dance moves and the whole dance changes. If I'm no longer operating from a place of perfectionism in an argument, if I've grown past that, then my husband's pattern in response to my perfectionism is going to shift. If he's no longer running an inner kid pattern based from childhood experiences of people pleasing, if he is actively growing past that, then my response to his people pleasing is going to shift. You can't do the same dance with someone if another person changes up the moves. And this is powerful because it means you don't have to wait for the other person to change for the relationship to be different. Really get that. You don't have to wait for the other person to change for the relationship to have a shot at being different. All right. So far, what I've been discussing for shifting old relationship dynamics is really boiling down to labels and frameworks can be a helpful way of understanding or explaining our experience, but don't get caught in them in a limiting way. And understanding people bring their quote unquote inner kid selves with them based on their childhood experiences into their relationships, and those inner kids might act out until the person learns other ways of operating. And if we learn different ways of operating ourselves, this has the power to shift old relationship patterns and dynamics, regardless of whether or not the other person in the relationship changes anything. All right, so that was the first section of the podcast, really getting into understanding some context for what we bring to relationships and how we might look at them. Now I'm going to move into some actual tools that you can use to start swapping out old relationship patterns and dynamics for new ones. First tool, asking, how can I support you right now? Instead of rushing to give your partner advice or tell them your analysis of their situation or getting angry on their behalf, oh my God, they were such a jerk. How do you even tolerate that boss? Or did it? Like, how can I support you right now? How can I support you right now? If you make it a habit to ask that question, you are empowering the other person to own their feelings and their experience and to enlist you as an ally in the way that they see fit. That can change an old relationship dynamic where one partner is really wanting empathy and listening, but the other partner assumes that the help the person wants is advice that fixes the situation. So, if you are the person in the relationship where you try to tell your partner about a problem or something that's bothering you, and they start giving you advice or telling you what you should do or getting angry on your behalf, introduce for them, hey, when I'm really struggling with something, I wanted to see if you would ask me this question and just really kind of stick to this question. How can I support you right now? And sometimes you might say you want advice, but a lot of times people are going to say, oh, I just want someone to listen and let me vent for a minute. And if you are the person in the relationship who has a partner who will vent to you and you try to say, hey, here's what could help you, and then they get mad at you, and you're over there feeling like, well, geez, like you don't want to be stuck in the problem. You're talking to me about it. Why are you talking to me about it if you don't want to find a solution for it? Recommend to you that you stop trying to help them find a solution. Let them propose the solution. Ask this question and ask it, you know, honestly and with empathy for what they're going through. How can I support you right now? Second tool, learning how to truly listen. And this is a skill that will benefit you everywhere in your life. And it's one that everyone can get better at. Sometimes people assume that they are already really great listeners, even if they could improve. And other times people don't want to own that they need some work with listening because who wants to think of themselves as not a good listener? Not me, right? But it's humbling, right? Like everyone can get better at listening. I can get better at listening. One way to improve your listening skills is through mirroring. When you mirror what someone has said to you, you aren't repeating someone's words back to them word for word. You're paraphrasing, checking for understanding. And you can check for understanding by literally saying, did I get that right? Or you can do it through your intonation by phrasing it as a question. So as an example, if my husband were to tell me kind of a long story about his workday, I would listen intently with the intent of mirroring back to him. I wouldn't repeat back exactly every single word that he said, but when there's a natural pause, I might say something like, so you were working on this project that the team said had to be done by end of day, and then they pulled the plug on it suddenly? So the intonation there is, this is a question. I'm kind of getting him to confirm. And mirroring can be paired with questions. So for those of you with partners who feel like you really have to draw them out, you wish they would disclose more about themselves, mirroring can be helpful with that. You can say things like, so you were working on this project that the team said had to get done right away or by end of day, and then they just pulled the plug on it suddenly? Wow, geez. How did that feel when they gave you the news? And then now you've got them talking about how they felt in response to the news. So it can be a helpful way to get people to disclose more when you're wanting to hear more about their lives so you can feel more connected to them. Third, get into the habit of having a word or a phrase that is a signal to the other partner that things are getting heated and need to slow down. The phrase my husband and I use is, can we take a breath to each other? So if I notice that he's being snippy, I might say, babe, can we take a breath? or he notices I'm being snippy, he might say the same thing to me. It goes both ways. And that is a signal phrase that really means, I don't want this to turn into an argument, so can we slow down a bit? And that phrase helps to release old relationship dynamics because then we're slowing down and getting more thoughtful before we get more reactive. You and your partner really need to choose what phrase you want to use though, because depending on what, again, what you grew up with, can we take a breath might somehow land on your partner if you just grab that and go, oh, that's good, I'll use that one. Can we take a breath might land on your partner as, are you telling me to calm down? Because I am firmly in the camp that never in the history of someone being told to calm down did they actually calm down. It's like, ooh, immediate escalation. Telling someone to calm down is a way of telling them that you think they're overreacting, and it's a way of minimizing something that is upsetting to them and essentially saying you shouldn't be that upset about it. So you figure out what works for you. It could be something like, can we slow down together? Can we take a breath together? I don't want this to turn into an argument. Can we pause? Or it just could be, let's take a pause. You know, so determine with your partner what that best phrase would actually be. All right, so today's podcast episode, there are entire books, right, that are written on improving relationships. I have been trying to keep this to what I see as the top tools that someone can use. And so first, there's understanding the dynamics that people bring and how those are rooted in past experience and trying to find ways to depersonalize it, not see someone's affect, if they're really upset, as quote unquote who they are, but a reflection of that inner kid that's been re-stimulated. And then looking at these tools that when you make them a habit in particular, really do start to loosen old relationship dynamics. And so to recap, those tools are asking, how can I support you right now? Instead of giving advice or analysis, really focusing on listening and using mirroring and checking for understanding as a way to make sure that you're actually listening and that the message the person is trying to communicate is being received by you in the way that they're hoping it will be received. And then having some kind of a word or a phrase that will be a signal between you and your partner that things are getting heated. You don't want it to turn into an argument. You need to slow down, need to take a breath, whatever that phrase might be. And all three of these together, the idea is that if you don't go down the well-worn path of, oh, I knew they were going to say that, or oh, of course you were going to do that, or, you know, I can't expect that you're going to actually da-da-da, like you're not going to change. Like it just keeps you out of going down that place where you're in the same old fight that you swear to God you've had 20 times and puts you at least in something of a position to really shapeshift the old dynamic. So I hope that those were helpful, and I'm always curious about how those go for people once the tools are released out into the wild. If you would like, if you have any other relationship questions, or if you have any ideas for future podcast episodes that you would like to bring to me, head on over to email and send an email to support@yourcourageouslife.com and give us a little bit of detail about what kinds of questions you have about relationships or anything else, and it might make it into a future podcast episode. All right, that's today's episode of the Your Courageous Life podcast. Thank you for listening. To dive in deeper and continue the work, head on over to yourcourageouslife.com. See you there.